You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
That cold case you're listening to? Nasty stuff. But you know what else is a crime? Missing even a moment of whatever you're doing to go on a drink run. Luckily, there's Drizly, the number one app for alcohol delivery. With Drizly, you can compare prices on the biggest selection of beer, wine, and spirits, then get them delivered in under 60 minutes. So download the Drizly app or go to drizly.com. That's DRIZLY.com today.
As Tommy makes his way across the quad for the first time, he's met by curious stares.
Hey, Tommy.
Hi.
And loud catcalls.
Hello, how are you? This is going to be killer.
Nikki, you describe the album as a tale of dirty needles, damaged minds, music industry battles, and a whole lot of sex. Is that fair?
I think that's fair. That's our story.
Well, Saints of Los Angeles was and is a whole different animal.
It's cool when you look out there and there's a 12-year-old with a Shout shirt on singing the words to Shout the Devil.
SOLA was done with Pro Tools. We'd send like hard drives around and it was so easy.
When you listen to the album, it's almost like watching a movie, you know, to me. Because it's, it starts out, I think, face down the dirt and ends with coming out swinging. And pretty much the story of our life is that album.
The album is a bit of a soundtrack to the movie that is, you know, going to be in production here very shortly.
Chicks Equal Trouble.
The crew, full on, right now, right here. Enjoy and crank the fuck out of it.
You're listening to the Cobras on Fire podcast, part of the Decibel Geek Podcast Network. This week, we kick off the first annual March Badness with the odious Motley Crue Records, Saints of Los Angeles. What does odious mean? Look it up, Tommy.
Tonight, it's gonna be a fight, so if you need a place to go, guys who roof strong, imagine sending a gun and the cops don't damn show.
Welcome to Cobras and Fire. My name is Baco, and I am joined by the filthy Loose Cannon. How are you this evening, Loose?
It's actually the dirty Loose Cannon, but I'm doing excellent. Thank you for asking. And how are you?
You told me it was filthy.
No, dirty.
All right. Well, then we're off to a bad start here. And we're going to try to coin and see if we can actually carry a theme for a month, March Badness.
Ooh. I like it. I like the pun.
Yeah, March Badness is just our little play on words. We're going to talk about things that are bad, basically horrible, shitty, sucky things. So if you see us promoting March Badness this month, we're just having a little fun. It really isn't that serious. Almost like everything we do.
Yes.
Unless I'm talking about Adele. I fucking mean that shit. That
fine young lady
sucks.
Hello.
Listen, Again, offending the if we did have a female audience, the one that we had is now already.
Hey, if a female's checking out our show, I don't think she's checking listening to Adele on the way home.
I don't think so. She's probably listening from prison. She's like the whole time. She's like just scratching her ankle because it's got a bracelet on it.
Yeah, like instead of these 10 million verified listens, we'll get new posters that say the number one prison podcast, the number one women's prison podcast.
Orange is the new Cobra.
Yeah. Oh man, well we got some beer to drink tonight.
We do. And who do we have to thank for this?
I want you to say it's a near and dear friend of yours.
Sure. It's Dave Brewington of the number 3 best podcast in Nashville, voted by some random organization where they then got to wear tuxedos to go there. And I don't know what the first two were. It wasn't Decibel Geek, so that was humiliating to them.
And us.
Well, we're not in Nashville, though.
Right, but by association, I mean, that's embarrassing for us.
That's true, yeah. But anyway, from the podcast is, if I hadn't already said it, Blame Your Brother. And so Dave Brewington graciously.
Brewington.
Get it? Yeah, Brewington. Get it? More puns. Mm-hmm. And yes, what did he gift us? What do we have that's giving me a little bit of a beer elbow from the weight.
Well, up here in Minnesota, we have a nickname for what I'm about to open, and we call it the oil can. Foster's Lager. It's Australian for beer, mate.
Beer. Foster's Australian for beer.
That's not a beer. This is a beer. And how many ounces is an oil can?
Mine is 723.
723 ounces.
Yeah, that is an Australian quart.
Beer. Foster's Australian for beer.
Anyway.
It is. So, these cans are fucking ridiculous. In 10 years, my grip will be too weak to drink one of these.
Beer. Foster's Australian for beer.
We'll be on episode 1,000. And some asshole give us it. And our wrists are so feeble and shaking. And they're giving us oil cans. It is ridiculous. It's not.
It is about a podcast worth of beer, though.
Beer. Foster's Australian for beer.
It really is.
I'm only had one beer, honey.
That's right. Just one. Just up. You know, this is basically 7-Eleven's Big Gulp.
Beer. Foster's Australian for beer.
You know what 7-Eleven, which is hilarious now, is it says
Foster's Australian for Big Gulp.
They have at 7-Eleven, which I've always found amusing, at least in the last, I don't know, 10 years or whatever like that, is it say like, do you want a fountain drink? It's 99 cents. And it doesn't matter if you get a large, an extra large, or they have like a 64 ounce one. Where the hell is drinking that?
Truckers.
I guess so. There's
truckers and preteens.
This should be good.
God. You know you have a problem when you're drinking that much fucking fountain pop. You know, it's like these are the people that, like, when they order their combo meal at, like, McDonald's, they always say, I'll take, you know, number 3 with a Coke, no ice.
Oh, yes. No, I was just going to go there. It's the no ice. Like, I don't want you to take away the 3 ounces you would be shafting me with that fucking ice.
Yeah, I'm really getting a fucking deal here on this shitty-tasting, watered-down, flat Coca-Cola. I mean, the thing is fucking piss warm halfway through it. and yep, you're getting a great deal, asshole.
Hey, it ain't cold, but I got an extra 3.
It ain't cold, and it stopped fizzing a week ago. Oh yeah! Do they even like bother hooking up the
carbonation?
The carbonation at 7-Eleven. I think it's just fucking tap water.
It's 7-Eleven. It's 7-Eleven. It's water and syrup. And it all 7-Elevens. I think it's standard that little nozzle that's on it sprays sideways. You know what I'm talking about? Yeah. Like some of it comes up, but 30% of it sprays on your wrist when you're trying to fill it up.
The type of guy that gets the 64 ounce pop at 7-Eleven is also the guy that, like, at a restaurant that has your fill your own pop, ask for a cup for water but secretly puts pop in it.
Oh yes, I'm sorry, that offended me.
Yeah, that's why you're not welcome back at Witch Witch. Tell the truth. It's the toilet story is a sham. It's because you tried to put pop in a water glass.
Get the fuck out of here with your scam of pop. I'd like to see somebody actually get called out in it once. Just once. Some rogue $9 an hour guy that's just like patrolling the...
Heroically patrolling.
I'm earning my money. You're getting out of here. Anyway, so back to the beer. That was a hell of a tangent. What are we, 5 minutes in?
Yeah.
So back to the beer. So would you like to open it up and if you can, and give it a review? By the way, my can is green.
Yeah, mine's blue. Mine's the right one. You got the wrong one. Of course. I'm sure yours is a little darker and heavier and a little more asshole-y than the one that Dave actually picked out. And once again, Loose Cannon does not get the proper thing. I would actually encourage the listeners to just buy the most simple macro thing that he can in no way claim that he couldn't find. Buy this guy Miller Lights. Buy him Budweiser. Get him Bud Light Lime for fuck's sake. Oh, wait, no, that's too obscure. He'll find a store that doesn't have it. How did you weasel out of it this time, Luz?
I don't see how this is weaseling out of it, because I'm pretty sure this is worse than the one that you're having. But the point is, I go there, and this is a pure, again, I love dealing with millennials in all retail situations. So I go, and I go to the whole...
Judge much?
Beers. I do judge. So for anybody that's 27, you know, just turn off your radio, because you're about to be offended. But... Don't worry,
I got your back, peeps.
So I go to the single beer section of Total Wine, and I can't find the Foster's. So I ask, where's the Foster's? And they said, oh, it's an imports, which makes me laugh.
You know what? I think that's far less ridiculous than when you go to a restaurant and it says all domestic beers are like $3, and then you ask for a Sam Adams, and like, well, that's not a domestic beer.
Yeah, okay, same kind of bullshit. You think that every one of these cans is traveling halfway around the world to get to your lips?
I know. I've had a few of these float back and forth in Ron Keel's hot tub.
But the point is that I go, I say, like, hey, where's the Foster's? Oh, it's in the import section. He shows this to me, and he goes, like, here it is, and he hands it to me. And I'm like, man, I remember this being either blue or purple. He's like, nope, that's the Foster's. And he goes, by the way, did you know it's from Australia?
Beer. Foster's, Australian for beer.
He mentioned that before that. And I go, yes, I did, but I remember this being a different color. He's like, nope, I've been here since this place opened, and it's always been a green Foster's can. I think this is the only one they've ever had. Maybe you forgot since you haven't had it for a while.
Beer. Foster's, Australian for beer.
Anyway, so I have this green can. So let me, would you like to now proceed in opening it and having a sip?
Yeah, let me see what I got here. Let me ask you something. Have you had it before?
I've had Foster's tons of times, but I've never had the green version. So.
Yeah, so I'm having the one that Dave actually bought. Much like the premium of last week, I've definitely got fucked up on this shit before. It's been a long time, but, you know, welcome back, baby.
Yeah, I'm going to open this, but it may break my finger. Here we go. There's actually a layer of oil. That's nice.
That's what it's called, an oil can.
Okay, so this says, mine's premium ale, Australia's favorite beer brand.
So it's not a lager?
Well, I have no idea. It says premium ale. Yeah.
Mine says Foster's Lager.
I would much prefer that.
Can I give my review?
Yeah, please. You go first.
All right. Yeah, I've always liked it. It's fine. If it was a little more readily available at like sporting events or concerts, I might tug one of these down once in a while. Yeah, it's smooth. It's a lighter, you know, it's not that deep European craft brew thing that seems to be the only thing craft brewers make in the United States. This is, I don't know, it's just a nice lighter flavor. I could see drinking this on a cool summer backyard barbecue, listening to the latest Meatloaf record.
On repeat.
That's a reference to an off-air phone conversation between me and Lewis. Anyway, your turn.
Okay, so here I go. This is actually not too bad. It's not somebody I go to, but so if you get the green can, it's definitely heavier. I think I would definitely prefer the other one. And I had Foster's a lot in college. I just never went to it. This is almost like a version of Steel Reserve or Colt 45 that doesn't suck, because it's $2.50 for this fucking monster.
So yeah, no, yeah, pretty, it was pretty good, fairly affordable.
Pretty good value, and I think the other ones were $4. So if you're looking to get really drunk and piss a lot, Foster's is the one for you.
Mm-hmm.
Yes? Yeah. Is that a review?
Hey, hold on a second. For some reason, Paul Hogan's here. Is he in your house?
He's always in my house.
Anyway, thank you very much, Dave Brewington. And someone get Paul Hogan out of here.
Dave, of course, contributed to the Buy Us a Beer program here at Cobras on Fire, which you can find at GoFundMe.com/AbsolutelyDrink. For $5, you get to pick the beer we drink on the show that night. We give our own personal review. We take a picture of us drinking it and post it on our social media page. And we talk about it, and we talk about you. So go to GoFundMe/AbsolutelyDrink, and you too, for $5, can pick up the beer we drink next week.
Well, before we get into today's topic, I did have one kind of quick review, if you want to call it that. It was a retweet. Actually, it was just a tweet mentioning us on Twitter. I read this tweet on Twitter. Oh, boy. The Fosters is kicking in already, I think. Anyway, this is a guy who actually regularly, you know, chimes in on Twitter or retweets. He's a fan of our show, Decibel Geek, a lot of our friends and stuff. But here's what he had to say. This is a guy named Christopher Stokes. Finally got a chance to listen to the newest Cobras and Fire podcast. Loose Cannon and Baco kill me. Most importantly, thanks for the intro to the Holy White Hounds and Bad Flower. Both bands kick ass. Psyched for the new damn things too. Thank you very much, Christopher Stokes. I hope you keep listening, and thank you for your support.
That actually commented on the actual music.
Yeah exactly. That's why I brought that one up. You know, yeah. It's like we get those from time to time, but we try to feature new music when we have it, especially by young bands, and it's good to hear that some people are hearing it and liking it. So, and the Holy White Hounds actually gave that little tweet a heart themselves.
Nice. We are now done with the 7-Eleven portion, the beer part, and the review portion of the show. Would you like to get into the dirt?
Yeah, let's kick off our first annual March Badness with a doozy. Motley Crue, Saints of Los Angeles.
So yeah, prior to Saints of Los Angeles coming out, it's kind of a weird time for Motley Crue, from New Tattoo, trying to kind of reinvent themselves as the old Motley Crue.
Yeah.
And which didn't really work that well. And then, you know, Tommy Lee was out of the band, he's in the band, and then there was a couple of reality TV shows. You got Vince Neil, like, getting a facelift and red hair. Or, I don't even remember.
Yeah, that was a weird one. I don't remember what that show would have been either. But and he lived in that house. What do they call that? Like, Celebrity Beach House or something?
Wasn't it rehab, though, was it?
No. It was not a rehab house. It was one of those things. It was almost like Big Brother, where you had to win competitions each episode. And it was like him. I don't think it was Webster and maybe it was like the Jaleel White. What was his name? Urkel.
That's right.
And Corey Feldman, I think, was on there. Ron Jeremy, maybe.
I think that was called Currently Unemployed. They had that, and then Tommy Lee went to college, and
the Apprentice too. You were talking about.
Well, the Apprentice was. I think the Apprentice was in the last 5 years, though. He kind of used those credentials. He also started a ton of Vince Neil himself. Just to mention this quickly, he was part of what was called the Motley Crues. So he opened all these ridiculous business ventures. So I moved down to Florida. He had Motley Crues, which turned into Shiprocked. He actually opened Dr. Feelgoods, which was a bar that sounds like it would play rock music, but only played dance music. And Nikki Sixx and the rest of the guys shut that down because he used that name without asking. Are you aware, though, that the members of Motley Crue sued Tommy Lee for damaging the name brand for doing that? Tommy Lee Goes to College thing.
I do kind of remember something about that.
Which is pretty funny. You know, the show has to be really bad.
I think people who graduated college should have sued Tommy Lee for damaging the reputation of colleges. The guy doesn't have a high school diploma. How is he going to college? I mean, there's no way that guy knuckled down and got a GED for a fucking reality TV show, right?
No.
Think about it, though. That actually makes sense. He sullied the Motley Crue name by trying to get himself educated.
That is true.
He went for higher learning. How dare you do that to our brand?
Tommy Lee, 25 years removed from high school and with no prior college experience, this hard-rocking badass faces the biggest academic challenge of his life. Final exams.
But just so you know, he never went to class. He was just in marching band. Do you remember that?
Yeah, it was a TV show, Lewis. I didn't actually assume he was doing any actual work.
Okay, I'm just letting you know.
He was on the swim team.
It was very hard for him to be in marching band, too. It was very challenging for some reason. I don't understand it. So the lawyers get together and make nice, all the members, and they get together to put out Saints of Los Angeles. Would you like to start with this?
So yeah, I was looking forward to it, but I was not anticipating to get the new 6 a.m. CD inside by accident. What about you?
But I remember like running from my job at the time. Just imagine me as a banker. imagine Loose Cannon as a banker. I ran out during lunch, got this thing, cranked it in the car, and upon my first pass, I liked the majority of it.
I was just, I'm sorry, I was just picturing you, like, you know, with your suit coat off, but still wearing a tie and dress shirt, in slow motion sprinting into Best Buy with, like, the Chariots of Fire song playing.
I think it was Best Buy, too. Yeah, I got it, and I was like, I put it in my, I don't know what that whatever car it was. And this is like this.
Honda Civic, number one car in Winnipeg.
Oh, that's true. Honda Civic. I was parked between spaces A1 and E5. So before we go into it, you want to throw in some details about the album?
Yeah. Let's get. It was released on my mother's birthday, June 24th, 2008. Produced by James Michael. Oh, that's my grandma's name. And James Michael Jackson. Do you like that one? That's one of your jokes. James Michael and DJ Aspa, DJ Ashba, did a second one there unintentionally. I'm trying to steal your bit.
Of bad jokes? Is that what you're saying? Yeah.
Bad jokes. Really stupid jokes.
Thank you very much.
And yeah, on Nikki Sixx's own E11.7 music. I guess Nikki has production credit on this as well. Just a quick note on James Michael and DJ Ashba, who are also in 6 a.m., with Nikki Sixx, and he had that record come out before this, which I think is going to have a lot to do with what I have to say anyway. But to me, those two are the musical equivalent of an Instagram filter. They're just, you know what? If you don't know what you're doing, they make it real easy. You're not going to get anything unique unless you get one of these 20 settings we have. DJ, play the reggae setting.
Well, yes. Yeah, so the songwriters on each track, and I think that's accurate.
Yeah, I have it in front of me.
The members of 6 a.m. Yeah, plus some songwriting from Marty Fredriksson, which, you know, he's done a lot of stuff. A lot to do with Aerosmith, if I remember right.
Mm-hmm.
Any other ones? Off the
Mick Mars gets a handful of songwriting credits on the back half of the record.
But basically, you have 6 a.m. writing the album, correct? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, all right.
And I'm pretty sure recording it too. But
mm-hmm. Yeah,
we'll get there.
The first track is called LAMF. Can you translate what that stands for? Just take a guess.
Left another MILF fart.
No, I think it's LA motherfuckers, but I'll go with that.
Los Angeles motherfucker.
Sure. But
LA is an abbreviation, you fucking dipshit. Get your head out of your ass.
So you want me to say Los Angeles?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. All right. This opening track.
This city full of plastic angels. Seduce you. Welcome to Los Angeles.
I have no idea what's going on. Vince Neil is talking, which he should never talk on ever, but he should certainly not talk on record. And you're talking about a band that have had some really cool intro tracks on some of their albums. I'll go, obviously, Shout the Devil. Fucking In the Beginning is a masterpiece. At least listen. I still think that's such an effective opening to an album. And yeah, I even like the little like 30 or 40 second thing in the beginning of Dr. Feelgood. I always want to hear that little
Terror
intro.
Terror in Tinseltown?
Yeah, before it kicks into the actual song. So to take those two is kind of like a template and pull out this. I don't even know what it is. What is your thoughts on it? And by the way, there's 1, 2, 3, 4. Yeah, it took 4 people to write this.
Oh, God. Was Cardi B one of the writers?
I believe so.
That guy from Panic at the Disco helped produce it. Oh, it's Saturday night. No, whatever. I honestly listened to it today. I don't remember. I remember it's garbage. I know you got like Vince saying some weird shit at the beginning. It basically is just a kind of a lead-in intro to the actual first song, Face Down in the Dirt.
Yeah.
Tommy Lee thinks this song is rad.
I think you're correct.
Yeah, I can just see him in the studio listening to the play, like, rad. Oh, I'm all over your bits today.
You are, but I can actually. You just kind of set me up nicely. I don't believe he was in the studio.
You know, I tried to listen back today. I think there are a handful of tracks that I'm pretty sure he played on. This was one of them, just because of the it's difficult to tell. They've really gotten, you know, drum machines to sound like drums. I'm pretty sure by this point that would have been accurate as well. But to touch on what we're talking about, you told me earlier today that you're pretty sure there's a decent amount of drum machine work on this record because of the connection to 6 a.m. I tend to think I wouldn't be shocked. I wouldn't even be shocked if Tommy programmed the drums. I know he's into that kind of stuff. Not so much because of the DJing thing. I suppose that helps learning how to do it. But because these are all rock beats and things of that nature. But something about the drum track on this one song and a couple others sound particularly live.
I will say there's like two or three songs total that sound like he's probably playing on it, but it's mostly the sound. It doesn't matter if there's Motley Crue albums I've liked or disliked, but the drum sound has always been on for me.
Yeah, like, but it's not been one really consistent sound.
No, but it doesn't sound to me, the drums on that, part of the thing that I have an issue with this album is the drums sound like they are on. Yeah, I'm not sure what they're called exactly, maybe synth drums, but they just have a very odd electronic sound to them that kind of stands out and takes away from a lot of these songs. I honestly think
my gut feeling is Tommy played on most of these songs. I couldn't find anything to talk about it in a web search. Like I said, it wouldn't really shock me if it wasn't, because they've gotten so advanced with the sound quality. Like, they actually sound like real drums. What you're describing to me really sounds more like modern day production, where I've talked about it in past episodes. This almost kind of flatness to every record that comes out in the last 10 years. Kind of, you don't get a lot of uniqueness to it. And I think it has a lot to do with digital recording. This might have tainted the whole record for me, because it was clear, you know, because I heard the same thing, like they were going to kind of do something like The Dirt. And I'm like, Nikki just did that with 6 a.m. With the 6 a.m. thing, I don't think there was any, like, plan. You know what I mean? It was like, I just kind of want to do this and put it out there. And then it actually was successful.
The first one, at least.
Yeah. Well, this was coming in right after that.
Sure.
Okay, so this is the time of this record coming out. They had the first one out, and he did the Heroin Diaries book, and it did well as far as selling. And then the companion soundtrack ended up being a successful, you know, musical entity. It sold a lot of copies. Life is Beautiful was a really big hit for them. And it's basically, you know, made 6 a.m. a viable touring act almost. Sure. Just that thing. But here's the mistake that people like Nikki and Gene Simmons and a lot of people do. They try to recreate something that worked. That part of the reason it worked is because they went in with no agenda. You know, I mean, I don't think they ever recorded 6 a.m. with the idea that they're going to be hanging platinum records on their wall. You know what I mean? I don't think those three guys thought they were forming a project. They were just doing something that Nikki kind of wanted to do to be a companion to the thing. And it was a cool idea. And now Nikki's like, hey, I got another book. We should do that, too. And it was clear on this song because, you know, and it's just, it's a lazy stab at, like, you know, I want to make a lot of money, but I don't want to go to school. I don't want to get a real job. I don't want to be you. I'd rather be dead. You know, the point being is, by the end of this song, I think there was a certain bias that was going to be difficult for the rest of the record to beat. I don't think these are good Motley Crue songs. I'm pretty sure Vince sang on it. Nikki may have not played bass on everything. It just doesn't sound like a Motley Crue record by the end of it. But this song is the first kind of domino to tip that made me start feeling that way.
Yeah, for 6 a.m., I like that album okay at first. And then now the only songs that stick with me is Life is Beautiful and the track right after it, Pray for Me. But I do like those two songs. But it kind of was like, it's kind of just overplaying a concept and whatever.
Yeah, it really is. And then I think that's a great way to state how I feel about most of this record, too. Anyway.
Yeah, yeah. So for this song, the first time I heard it, I was like, not that bad. But it was so simplistic where, you know, when you come to Motley, you're at least going to have some riffs. And this thing was just like, that was basically the song. And the chorus is pretty grating. It's not very melodic. And I was just like, all right, it's got some attitude, but it's just not doing anything for me. Didn't hate it at first. I do not like it now, but I'm just saying, but that's my first impression. I was like, well, you don't like that one? Next one's going to be better.
It just doesn't feel like a band that was driven to do music. It was just like, whatever. Just record the damn thing and let me know when to show up for to shoot photos for the album cover.
What do you think about the album cover? I like it.
Actually. Yeah, actually, the entire packaging, the album cover, all the photos, I think it's great.
Yeah, I thought that was the pictures of the band and everything like that. I thought they did a nice job with it, as they always do.
Yeah, actually, for the most part, I thought Generation Swine was a crappy cover, and I didn't. I don't think 94 was good.
That's right. Yeah, there's a couple of missteps, but for the most part, this is the band that changes their logo every time. They have some creativity with the album covers.
Generally speaking, like yes, that. I agree.
Next track, What's It Gonna Take?
What's it going to take to make it?
It is. And this song, not that bad. It's my second and not that bad on this one. I honestly, the thing is that
this is
going to
be like the flip-flop of the Van Halen 3.
what I just say, that's right. I'm okay with it, and you just despise it, right?
Yeah, carry on.
But this one, obviously, like I said, like I imagined, because I'd read The Dirt and kind of, the kind of for 8 years or whatever, thinking about an album that was going to have at least some of that, thought was kind of a cool idea. So this one, What's It Gonna Take? It's kind of, there's actually really only four or five songs on this album that are really about The Dirt. The rest of it's just some other stuff.
I don't know. As I researched it today, I tried to kind of place the songs into the timeline of where they would have fit.
Interesting. So this one obviously is, the first one is, hey, we want to be rock stars. The second one is,
there's more Nikki's story, the first one. Sure. My parents hate me. I'm dropping out of school. I'm running away from home. I'm not going to be a banker, Dad.
I'm not going to be a banker that listens to this album.
This one is them wondering how many ugly girls Tommy has to fuck for them to get signed.
Okay. Excellent.
This would be just before Too Fast for Love.
Sure. This one I think is okay, where it's just kind of talking about the Sunset Strip, this, that, and the other, but it doesn't stick. But I don't hate it. I just think it's it doesn't do anything really for me.
Yeah, I just the lyrics are just garbage.
I don't think it's that bad.
So we wrote another song, cut a demo on a dime. They didn't like the sound, we didn't fit the times. The radio station said it's way too loud. I mean, come on, man. He mailed that in with a lot of postage.
What about I'm a sorry motherfucker tired of living in the gutter? What's it going to take? That's my point. Well, this is the first F-bomb of the album, which I think this hits a record for them.
It's actually too much. It stands out. Like
it does.
Maybe it's Vince. We'll get into this on a song later on, but it becomes apparent. Part of the problem is Vince can't sell this record. Like, he can't sing it in a way that's believable. I mean, he actually sounds okay on the whole record, but you don't buy into it, I guess.
This is actually the first album that I think that he was really, if you listen to it, I remember after repeated listens, I was like, yeah, I think this guy is auto-tuned. I think he was in, this is right around the time. I don't remember when auto-tune really became a thing.
Well, around this time, auto-tune wasn't what people, how people talk about, let's say, Photoshop that with almost no idea that Photoshop's an actual program. Right. And that what they're actually just asking you to do is find some way to manipulate this. That's kind of what auto-tune has become. What you're talking about is pitch correction. And auto-tune, I think, does that now. But around this time, you remember that Kid Rock song, Only God Knows Why? Auto-tune was more like for that. Or that Cher tune. But I have a different theory. Vince, like, this is the Vince being thankful for digital recording. He sang two words at a time. Took a breath. It's like, we were
back it up. And he just, so it took him like, well, remember we were talking that like Tom Werman was saying that Vince would, he would put in the work. He's not afraid to spend 12 hours in the studio to record 3 minutes of vocals.
It is amazing. Anyway, it seems very like slapped together. But again, you know, nice attempt, but no. But can I move on to the next song? Down at the Whiskey.
We slept all day in our clothes. That's okay in Hollywood. Another shot, another show.
This one is, if I'm going to compare it to the rest of the album, this is one of my top songs on the album. I like the lyrics on it. I like the beginning part. I can imagine Nikki Sixx just like playing his guitar and like spinning around on stage. And
you have some weird visualizations when you spin it, Nikki. Give us a twirl, bitch.
You know what I'm talking about when he's on. Anyway.
Yeah. You want to see the backside, baby.
This one just has, this one is melodic. You know, of this, if they had just had just one song that was kind of like their origin song, if you took out the other two of the beginning and they said, this is kind of our, we're coming to the Sunset Strip and trying to make it, I would be okay with it. After two that are kind of similar to it, It's a little too much.
Yeah, but the timeline, this would be shortly after the other song, because now they're living in that apartment. Here's a little fun fact for you. I don't know how much you know about that apartment that is kind of notorious if you've read the book, The Dirt.
Of course,
I think the three of them lived in. Mick, you know, still had his own, you know, he probably had like he lived in a trailer park somewhere by himself. But because he's like 70 years old at this time.
Do you know, the actual age was 30. Yeah, started, which is amazing.
There's
if you think
no
about
fucking
it.
Chance that's true. But anyway,
you think he was older than 30?
I saw a picture of him in 1972, and he was pushing 30 then. So, it was like one of his bands in the early 70s. Anyway, I actually just on a lark just kind of Google mapped like I found the address, and then I use Google Maps to find it, and then I do that actual Earth view thing, or you know, the street view thing. And I'm like, and they always said it was really close to the whiskey. So I looked at it. It's literally like a block away. Like they're on the same street. You can see it from their front driveway.
Wow.
A band that has some somewhat, I don't know, questionable believability to some of the stories you heard. Suddenly some things kind of like, well, maybe there's some truth to this. You know, they literally probably did bring half the bar back with them on nights.
Sure. Anyway, this song is catchy. It sticks in my head. Is it a great song? No, but in this context, it's okay.
I agree. This one might be the closest to sounding like an actual Motley Crue song. I don't know. It kind of, a lot of this stuff kind of reminds me of when Vince first went solo, and like at the time, like Jack Blades and Tommy Shaw were, you know, like the hot rock duo to write with, and so he brought them in, and you know, he sang on their songs, and that's kind of what this sounds like. He's singing on songs Hired Guns wrote.
Just to hear Whiskey A Go-Go, you know, in an actual Motley Crue song, for whatever reason, I like it. And then the other part is that when my brother lived in L.A., one of the things I was determined to go to was the Whiskey. So I went there, and there's just some local terrible band playing it. That place is tiny.
Mm-hmm.
And there was like maybe two or three other bands represented. There was Motley memorabilia everywhere. I mean, this is like the early 2000s. And it was just kind of cool to see that they were basically just like crowned this, that they owned that fucking place, and that it still was still there all that time later, is a reference. So, but I was really surprised how tiny it was.
Paul Stanley made them cover up all that stuff with his own paintings when Kiss just played there for Sirius XM.
The painter went around and just put mustaches on everybody.
By the way, a real quick side note on Paul's paintings. How come they're all self-portraits?
What do you mean? Why?
Moving on. The next up is a title track, Saints of Los Angeles. This seems like a good opportunity for me to interject my own little conspiracy theory as to why the album title was changed from The Dirt to Saints of Los Angeles.
Please.
Right around this time, Janie Lane had a project with Bobby Blotzer, I think Robbie Crane, I can't remember who the guitar player was, called Saints of the Underground. And yeah. They actually did some music and released it. And it wasn't, too long after that I heard that they were changing the name of the record to Saints of Los Angeles. I think I think Nikki liked that title and kind of took it and borrowed from it a little bit. And this is a song, and this will be a repeating theme, and then I'll turn it over to you. I'm pretty sure the title was written long before any music or lyrics were.
If this album was completely deleted from history and this was only a single, it would be a better thing. I love this song. It is Vince Neil is as sleazy as he is in Wildside. I love the lyrics. I like the whole, just the vibe of it. It's the same thing. It's pretty much, it is the only good song they've put out since
Sex.
this preceded Sex. But I love the chorus. Like I like the fact that they keep it in the set list. I like this song.
Hmm.
Go ahead.
It's probably the best song on the record. It feels fabricated. It just doesn't sound. It's clear these guys don't fucking do a damn thing together now. But when I bought the record, I don't think I was aware of it. And I was really, again, I'm still annoyed that the two guys from 6AM are basically writing the damn record. It really pushed it over the edge when you got fucking Jacoby Shaddix from Papa Roach, the Buck Cherry singer, and
oh, I don't like that.
There's who's the other dude?
There's a guy randomly from a band.
The Las Vegas.
No, that was a good guess, but it was actually another band on their label. Oh, Rock and Roll Devils or Devil of they're Charm City Devils. There's two versions of this, by the way. There's for oddly the single that I have does not have the gang vocals, and that is the more superior one. And it also does not have the 45-second bullshit intro. It just goes right into the song.
I'm familiar with the two different versions, but nothing really gets my doucho meter going more than Jacoby Shaddix's face in his stupid band, and just such a fucking poser. And weren't they basically part of a package tour too? Everybody's band, like Buck Cherry and them. Yeah, and Buck Cherry was a band that had some promise, I thought, that really turned into be a fucking pile of shit. I do like Josh Todd as a singer, but I mean, really, what a talk about a waste. But anyway, that didn't sit well with me. I just didn't like it, okay? Get over it, Wally Gator.
Wally Gator is always the measure of what a good piece of quality work is, don't you think?
Yeah, I definitely use him to gauge what side of the fence I should be on an artist.
it's Rip Magazine and Wally Gator.
Yeah,
those are the two things.
That's my two sources of
So, but going to, I think this is a good segue into Crewfest really quick.
How long are your concerts?
The Crew Fest that we're going out to do is a little bit shorter because there's five bands. When we do our own.
We play an hour and a half.
It's
an all-day event with all these bands.
Last year when we played, we played almost 3 hours.
Yeah.
Because we didn't have an opening act, so we were able to play, without just us.
This tour is how long?
We're on for an hour and a half.
Yeah.
But the band, I think the first band probably go on at
five. And how many
cities?
40 on this run, only in America and in Canada, and then we'll go from there.
You go around the world?
Yeah, we always go around the world.
We'll finish up in 2009 sometime.
Are you big in the Orient? Are you big in Europe?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Especially in the Orient.
Are you alive?
Yeah, I'm here.
Did you pass away?
No. I'm the only one that is still alive.
I'm 86.
There's a little more of me with Motley Crue. You might say this is really behind the scenes. Let's rock and roll.
Because basically they put everybody that was on that tour on that track.
Yeah, okay.
You know what I mean? So
yeah, because 6 a.m. toured with that crew fest too, didn't they?
Well, that's what I was saying. That was a bizarre thing. Where did you go to that one or not?
I did not. No.
Okay, I did not either. And I'll go into Crew Fest too, just for a quick story on that too. But so the lineup was exactly what you said. It was Buckcherry, Papa Roach,
6 a.m. and Trapped.
Oh, what a terrible lineup, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they put their name on the banner of what this is going to be, and these are the bands, and I think they are all on. I might have this wrong. I know this is more accurate for round two, but it is funny the fact that it didn't even intentionally do this. But we were talking about 7-Eleven earlier, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what Nikki Sixx's label is?
Yeah, 11-7.
Okay, which I thought was always kind of amusing. I think all these are associated with a label. It definitely was for Bobby.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, these bands have all been on there at some point. I guess I don't know about Trapped, I'm guessing, but...
No. Yeah, but... So,
that would be
anyways,
a very Nikki Sixx, I want to be Gene Simmons move to do.
Right. But look at this, though. I mean, the fact that that 6 a.m. was, I think, playing in the middle of this lineup, the fact that he played twice was he was basically using Motley Crue to promote the band he really wanted to be big.
Yeah.
Kind of.
Yeah, he really did kind of. Because what was that thing he did with Tracy Guns, Brides of Destruction? That really didn't turn out, I think, at all like he was hoping it would.
Right.
Because he bailed on that real quick.
Yeah, he did. I actually like a couple of tracks on that, too.
It's a much better record than this album.
yeah. Yeah, he was doing that. Then he did, like, that side that... there's a lot of times when he does an album right when they put a Motley Crue up. Like, he put out a solo album called 58. Did you ever hear that?
Yeah, I never heard it. I know what you're talking about, though.
Okay, he put that out at the same time of New Tattoo. And there's kind of enough songs on both to make one pretty solid album, but he kind of split the difference on his solo stuff, kind of like the 6 a.m. thing. I think there's... But it's just that is a shitty lineup. Now, if you thought that was bad, can I please give you the lineup for Crew Fest 2?
Sure.
The first Crew Fest, they did, obviously they were focused on the Saints of Los Angeles. Do you know what they were focused on the next Crew Fest? The year after that
greatest
album was
hits.
Out? No, they played the entire album of Dr. Feelgood album because it was some anniversary, 20th anniversary, top to bottom.
Oh, yeah. Actually, I have the anniversary CD of that has, like, I don't know if it's a whole live show, but it was to commemorate that tour.
Okay. Well, that means that you got to hear Time for Change and She Goes Down live. I mean, Sticky Sweet. You got to hear all the Rattlesnake Shake. If you haven't heard Rattlesnake Snake live, then you have not lived.
At this point in the history of Cobras on Fire, my view on play the entire record in sequence is clear, right? I'm against.
Yeah. Well, me as well, and I can go into that the next episode. But that lineup was Godsmack, Drowning Pool, Theory of a Dead Man, and Charm City Devils.
Oh, my God. I mean, where are the when you need them?
I know. And I actually got back in my other back in my life.
That was a horrible thing to say.
Oh, that really was. Yeah, I think you went, we might have to. That is, oof.
It's staying in.
Oh, God. Jesus. I think we hit new level. I
was
just
like,
it
was Nickelback short of that's enough. I'm going.
So I was reviewing for a website that was just a really pretty much a bad version of DecibelGeek.com.
Okay.
So I got the passes free, and I actually interviewed the lead singer for Charm City Devils and Drowning Pool, and actually got like a video of it somewhere on YouTube if you want to see a much younger Loose Cannon do a terrible interview. And,
I actually kind of like Drowning Pool just a little bit.
I do too, actually. There's the only album I like, though, is the self-titled one. But I hated The Bodies. I didn't like that crap. Like, have they had three singers now?
At least four.
Is it four?
It's got to be, yeah. But
okay.
Yeah, whatever. Anyway. We don't have to get too deep into it. I don't think I like one album all the way through by them, but they've had some songs that I've really dug.
Agreed. Yeah, on that, they're the shining star. But this is also the tour where Godsmack got mad because they actually said that we should be headlining above Motley Crue because we're
different
a bigger
band stories
than
they are. Though. That's what Motley Crue says. I mean, I've heard Godsmack's side; it's a little different. You know, I kind of like the whole Sully versus Nikki Sixx thing. It kind of reminded me of David Lee Roth versus Sammy Hagar, and how no matter what Sammy did, no matter how right Sammy even might have been at times, he always ended up looking like the doofus. You know what I mean? And that was very much because, like, I heard Sully talk about, like, you know, he asked for some passes, and they said you got to talk to Nikki, and Nikki. just gave him stickers and wrote pass on him. He went. And look, I don't know what actually happened or what the beef was. You know,
it's a great story, though.
Yeah, no. And the fact, but again, this is Sully telling the story. Who looks cooler in that story? I think Nikki hands down wins that one.
Oh, yeah. Big time.
And that's not... look, I know you hate Godsmack. I don't really hate him that much, but... I mean, Sully does have fucking Napoleon complex. We all know that.
Who is it? Is it Sully or is it Nikki? Who is the motherfucker of the year?
You think the song might have been written about him?
Ooh.
Oh, wait, no, it wasn't Crew Fest 2 afterward. Yeah, okay. Because
no,
they wrote what the song about a bitch.
Right.
About Nikki Sixx, but...
Yeah, I think it was called Smack a Bitch.
Yeah. Crying Like a Bitch.
There you go.
Another like just a equally clever title.
That's right.
It might as well have been on this fucking record.
Yeah. So next track is one that I think Tommy Lee actually did play on. Mm-hmm. It is Motherfucker.
It sucks. It's basically they keep kind of trying to rewrite almost the same chorus. Here I am, hey now, I'm the motherfucker of the year. We are.
You did get it. It's a shittier version.
Yeah, it's just it's just this kind of big chorus thing that they were doing with 6 a.m. and this. I don't know. It did nothing for me. And it seems a little too earnest trying to say motherfucker, man. I mean, Tommy
right.
Lee wanted
That's
to call
it
rad as fuck of the year.
Now you're taking my jokes.
All day. That's this episode is Baco's being loose cannon today. How's it feel?
Yeah, raddest motherfucker of the year was the working title. I mean,
that's better. Yes.
Yeah.
See, that's why you get those jokes, because you know how to do it.
Okay, fine. They're all terrible, any variation of them. But so yes, this song is the antithesis of what Motley Crue is, though. Does this sound like at all, if Vince Neil was not on this track, that would you think this is a Motley Crue song at all?
No. Nothing about this song. But I'm basically describing every song to this point. This does not sound like a Motley Crue record, other than Vince Neil's voice. I don't think Mick Mars plays a lot of guitar on this record.
Yeah, there's too many guitar solos. I do think the guitar solo at the end of Saints of Los Angeles is also really good.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's when he...
There are I didn't take great notes on the leads on here. There are some that I think it's clearly him. You can kind of hear his style come through. But some of them, you know, some of them have that kind of like, I can play anything kind of approach that DJ Ashba has. He doesn't really have like a unique sound or style. He can just like, oh, you want something that sounds like this?
I was glad to actually just fucking hear him again after no solos in Generation Swine, and there was just a tiny bit of of that. And anyway, so that I think he does is decent on the album. But yeah, this song, this is when I'm listening to the album, I'm like, okay, I feel that wherever I was going and whatever happiness I was having this album, we are going directly downhill at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Because things make a big change after this. And again, too much force. At this point, we've heard the chorus is motherfucker. I think we've heard fuck about 35 times at this point on the album. Yes.
It
doesn't fit. They've never even had fuck in any of their songs before, I don't think.
Yeah, and it sounds forced. You know what I mean?
Yes,
it does. Look how edgy. It's like people, it's almost like they're trying to write songs not about the dirt, but about the reaction to the you're like, oh my God, you guys fucking did this. It's like, oh my God, we did that. It's like it just dawned on them what they would done, you know. If Saints of Los Angeles was probably about Shout at the Devil, you know, time, Motherfucker of the Year is probably, we're looking at Girls, Girls, Girls going into Theater of Pain or Dr. Feelgood.
Sure. Yeah. And this leads into a leftover track from 6 a.m.'s Heroin Diaries, and that is The Animal in Me.
This sounds to me like he's writing about his relationship with Vanity, which would tie into your theory, because she plays a big role in that novel.
Oh, I see. Oh, you think this is actually I didn't even make that connection. After Saints of Los Angeles, none of these songs seem like this is has anything to do with the dirt to me.
I see them continue a theme through this, but...
All right. Your thoughts on this track?
Yeah, it's garbage. I don't know.
Okay.
It's
I can't believe
it never heals, the deepest cut you feel, the thing that you feeds, the animal in me. I don't know.
No, I agree. It's garbage as well. And the thing is that it's one of these songs too that Nikki or somebody in the band must have, well, of course it's Nikki, liked so much that they shoehorned it on two greatest hits packages that they repackaged. I don't know if you knew that, but it's there in case you wanted to have it. And it's a remix of it.
Well, they've got a lot of them, so I'm not sure where to find them. I don't typically look at track listings on greatest hits now that you mention it, but...
They completely... the Decade of Decadence doesn't exist anymore.
Oh, really?
Anywhere. Deleted
bullshit. It's in my fucking CD rack, bitch.
I'm talking about like if you're going to buy it or you're in their, of course, their streaming catalog, it's been replaced with one version of their greatest hits, and that also has The Animal in Me on it, just so you know.
You know, Two Sides of the Coin was on a greatest hits kiss record.
I told you, you didn't believe me back in the day.
Yeah, like I said, I actually own the thing, and I didn't like – I thought you were just trying to make one of your horrible jokes.
No, it was a horrible truth.
It was a horrible truth. Oh, man. I had some to say there.
I'm not sure if we need to go track by track on this at this point, Baco. So I'm just going to go, your thoughts on Welcome to the Machine.
Well, just like The Animal in Me, and this is another clever title. They definitely spent some overtime coming up with song titles on this record. I definitely wrote the title, then wrote the song. I liked this song the first time I heard it when it was called Shot Full of Rock on the Ace Frehley Trouble Rock Walkin' record.
I was hoping it was going to be a Pink Floyd cover.
Yeah, it would have been. Well, Motley Crue doesn't have a great track record with covers. Welcome to Machine.
This is just a throwaway. Just here it is. And then how about any other thoughts on this? Because I think we can just kind of blaze through some of this here.
Well, let me just get a little of some of these lyrics, man. I did some research here.
Okay, please. I didn't know. I told myself not
to. My favorite line in this is, rotting to the core, give your ass like a whore. Once you take hit, you need a little more, more, more. More rhymes with whore and core. Truth. That's all I got.
So, with that said, just another psycho.
Welcome to the Machine, though. That would be the Dr. Feelgood tour.
What do you mean?
They're just talking about basically just get out there, keep going. Night after night, we're keeping you on the road. Same old situation, baby.
dude, you're actually opening up my mind to this. The fact that you think it's did you research this online?
I literally have printout of all the lyrics, and I read them as I listened to the record today.
Okay, well, I guess after that we go into, like I said, Just Another Psycho, which here's my analysis on it. It's a terrible Alice Cooper song.
Yeah, it's another clever title. This has got to be like, I don't know, when he during his heroin days a little bit. So this might be a little off the timeline, but it worked better sequencing maybe. But again, who knows? When, you know, Nicky kind of relapsed a lot.
Baco. This really helped the album with the sequence. Here. if they had just adjusted a couple of these songs, it'd be a much better album. Hey, Baco?
Yeah.
Can I tell you something?
Sure.
I went to the doctor. It wasn't a shocker. When he said I should know, I'm just another psycho. Is this a limerick? Where's the guy? Where's the man from Nantucket? This dick's so long it can suck it, whatever it is.
Well, you know, Dr. Seuss was dead, so there's this opening. You know, like someone can fill in the shoes.
Oh, okay.
It's gonna be Nicky Sixx.
You know, Baco, I should be committed for being so twisted. Everybody knows I'm just another psycho. I'm not okay. it's just garbage. Just another garbage song. Was their working title. Let's go to next track, please. Is probably my favorite one on the album.
Nicky, he finds influence in certain things. I don't know if he specifically saw the printout of the title "People Equal Shit" by Slipknot, but that just kind of seems like a couple references throughout this record where he just kind of like he didn't rip off a song. He kind of took kind of a message or something like that, and Chicks Equal Trouble seems really generic to me. The opening riff on this, I don't know if you're familiar with the Gilby Clark song, Cure Me or Kill Me. It does seem like he may have borrowed from that a little bit. I do have some notes here that this definitely sounds like a Mick Mars solo on this song, and Tommy Lee thought this song was rad.
Oh, he absolutely thought it was rad. By the way, I am amazed that this song is not just co-written, but only written by Tommy Lee. When I first saw this, I mean, I laughed when I saw the title to begin with and I grabbed the album. And I imagine, though, and why I say it's a Tommy Lee written song is it's Tommy Lee in high school being told to come up to in math class to and I can imagine like this, like Albert Einstein, like writing all this stuff on the end, and his end of his equation is just chicks equal trouble on that, which also on the same test he wrote 2 + 3 = jello.
Then he like flips the chalk over his shoulder, walks out of school never to return.
That's right. He's out of college. This is what he did. Tommy Lee. This is part of Tommy Lee goes to college. This is what he learned.
Man,
it's just fucking awful. Chicks equal trouble, and do you have any lyrics you want to share? Because the lyrics are amazing.
Well, I think we should at least explain the overall theme to the listener, that basically what they're saying is that chicks equal trouble. There's an underlying message that you won't get from the title other than you'll know exactly what it's about. I don't know. I mean, the chorus is probably good enough. Chicks equal trouble. You add it up, you get what you get. All right, let me sing that. Chicks equals trouble. You add it up, you get what you get. I don't know, whatever. You step right in it. So
yeah, you always step right in the shit.
Yeah.
Again, that's really cool when you're saying shit and fuck, and you're saying gold digging whore. They say gold digging whore. Is this Steel Panther?
Yeah.
I mean.
Yeah, it's almost like this. God. This was like the template for every Steel Panther song.
It really
throw
is.
In a line about an Asian hooker, and you're good to go.
Like, all right, let's move on from Tommy Lee's theorem that chicks equal trouble. Yes?
Yeah, that's rad, man.
You know what the working title was for this?
What's that?
Rad equals gnarly.
I think this whole episode is lacking some working titles. Let's see if we can squeeze a few in here before the end. Rad equals gnarly. I like that. Hey, who do you think's dead? Did you ever see that movie Forgetting Sarah Marshall?
Yes, of course.
Who do you think is dumber, Tommy Lee or Paul Rudd's character in that movie?
How long you lived out here?
Man, I don't know. I quit wearing a watch when I moved out here.
Wow, that's so cool.
Yeah. No, like my cell phone has a clock on it, so I don't really need it.
I always go Tommy Lee. Yeah. Yeah. Listen, Tommy Lee paid to have a Starbucks into it, built into his house at one point. That's all you need to know.
That's the worst example you can give of how dumb he is. That's like the one good idea the guy's ever had.
What, so he can't leave his house? Does he need that? Why does he just buy the coffee? Well, he doesn't need this actual Starbucks person there 24/7.
Yeah, but this is kind of pimped out and cool. You know what I mean? You know, it's like he knew MTV was coming over to film his crib.
Okay. Well, let's take.
You know,
that.
Tommy. You want an example of Tommy Lee being dumb? He was trying to, kickstart his solo career, so he hired Chad Kroeger to write his songs.
Is that true?
Yeah,
I didn't know who the co-writer was for that stupid Tommy Lee album.
I don't know is it that one that has the "Trying to Be Me" song on it.
Yes,
I mean that's basically a Nickelback song. What was that one called? Rad equals.
Rad divided by gnarly equals.
Hold on, squish.
That's right.
Anyway, the next song up is another clever title called "This Ain't a Love Song." The next song up is "This Ain't a Love Song." Another clever title.
Sure, because it's true. Because this is a fuck song.
You know, let me ask you something real quick about the songwriting. Do you think the generic titles, to me, that is just the influence of Ashba and Michael just seeping in?
I guess.
I'm not even sure how much work Nicky did on songwriting. He might have been the freaking Rick Rubin of songwriters on this record.
Well, I have a theory that Nikki Sixx has never written a single part of 6 a.m. nor played bass on it.
Actually, I think that too.
Like, it doesn't seem like when people say like 6 a.m. have, like, just the fact that Nikki Sixx is in there, you're kind of curious to listen to it. Then you actually listen to it past the first album, which had a couple good songs. There is nothing that connects it to Motley or anything. There's not a drop of Nikki Sixx in that. There's just that he put his name on.
You look at everything he's ever done. This is just like, I don't know. It just seems like a transition he's not capable of making. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. Yeah. And
He's the name, and I don't know. It's kind of like Donald Trump throwing his name on a building.
At this point, the listener has heard fuck, I think, 75 times, which is fine for our show, but not a Motley Crue album, damn it.
No. I mean, I got kids.
That's right. Anyway, I have nothing else to say to this.
Yeah, the song is garbage. I don't know. I mean, today was probably the second time I listened to it since I bought the record.
And it does have the line that's a terrible homage to Prince, which is, she bent down to the bedpost and I watched little Susie grind. Yeah. No joke.
Leave Prince right out of there. This, man.
I think I do need to, yes.
Yeah. No, I meant Nikki.
Oh, yes. Okay. All right.
So, you're just reporting facts, man.
I am, but this song, I mean, between Chicks Equal Trouble and This Ain't a Love Song, my brain has actually just been removed from its stem. All right, at this point, this trilogy of songs, Just Another Psycho, Chicks Equal Trouble, and This Ain't a Love Song, is probably the worst three-song run of Motley Crue. And that includes anything on Generation Swine, anything like that. This is completely unredeeming. I can't even, yes, no?
You definitely don't want to be listening to these songs while you're studying for the SATs. You're going to be dumber when you listen to these.
Oh, my God. I just saw it. This is perfect. Are you aware that Tommy Lee has co-written credit on the Saint of Love song?
Yeah, he does. Yeah.
It's the only one on there, and it is the dumbest song on the album. I rest my case.
I'm thinking he came in and said, dude, it'd be rad if we changed line to wine.
I don't know. But so it goes there. You hit White Trash Circus, which is actually amazingly, this was actually another single of it. And Motherfucker of the Year was a single too, which is genius that they did that. And I don't even know what I can tell.
White
you about
Trash
this.
Circus. Did you like that? I think the laugh at the end. It might even be Vince.
No. No, I didn't notice that. Is Vince laughing at the end?
I don't know. I mean, no, just. To me, that's the thing that sticks out about this whole song, is that really, really bad attempt at some kind of like maniacal laughter.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, and then going out swinging? No, they did not.
Yeah, they did not go out swinging on this record. This is them basically saying, look, we're Motley Crue. You know, we're going to fight you.
Oh, we've come to the end of this album. When you get done listening to this album, all you really want to do is grab a copy of Too Fast for Love to kind of cleanse the palate.
Yeah, right? I don't know, something to numb yourself, you know. These guys like to do drugs. I don't have any. What do they call cocaine back in 83? Krell? They had it written on the back of the Shut at the Devil record. I need some Krell to pick me up now, because this album is a total goddamn bummer. And again, Wally, all apologies to Wally Gator, but this record is complete fucking garbage.
This album makes New Tattoo and Generation Swine so much better in comparison. In a way, this showed that they were done. I mean, after this, the only new music they put out was Sex, and then the amazing single The Dirt, I think. I think that's the only two other songs they put out past this.
Yeah, well, the there's three other tracks coming out for the movie, but I think they're dropping the same day as the movie on March 22nd, which we may or may not be talking about by the end of this month, right?
Yeah, we might do a review of The Dirt.
But yeah, to me, the one takeaway from this is that as a functioning band, there was nothing left. I mean, they could go out and play live shows as long as they all showed up in their own buses. There's no cohesiveness to this. They didn't get together and write songs. Any co-writes were like add-ons after the songs were written. It doesn't sound like a band at all. And it's kind of depressing because I think they were one of the, if you're going to put a band from the hair metal era, whatever you want to call it, 80s metal, glam metal, in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, this is the most legit band. But honest to God, when you look at their career, and it's not really all that uncommon with the Hall of Fame. They're getting it on one or two records, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But this is definitely not the one they're getting. <that's> gonna...
And now, the writers of This Ain't a Love Song, It's Just a Fuck Song, Motley Crue. I mean, come on. You look at this, too, and I got to tell you, for some of these albums we've done, albums nuked, whatever you want to call it, March Badness, I would take Sonic Boom over this. I really would. That's
Man,
not a joke.
That's a good thing to – I'll get back to you. It's pretty close.
I mean, I'll take Sonic Boom immediately over this album. I will take – I may even take Van Halen 3. Nah, never mind. But the
I'll take Van Halen 3 over this one. By a nut. I'll take it by a Eddie Van Halen lead vocal track.
Oh, you still love that Eddie Van Halen vocal track. Okay.
Yeah, love 1 minute of it.
100% right now. Sonic Boom is hitting the CD player before this. My God. And it's like this is an album that sounds like it was produced by lawyers.
Yeah, pretty much. It's almost like, I don't know, like a marketing piece to tie into a tour. We need new artwork for T-shirts,
and I think that they are were
and they had already just released 17 greatest hits records, so.
Right? And it was and I think they were self aware of themselves enough to immediately drop it as a way to market themselves. They immediately went from Crew Fest to Saints of Los Angeles to just saying fuck it, we're just going to celebrate Dr. Feelgood and go on that. Within a year, I mean, all the songs were the only song they played was "Saints of Los Angeles" from it on that tour.
Okay,
you see my meaning.
Yeah,
so it was a failure in general, and it is a failure for my ears. It is depressing me to no end. This entire conversation, Baco. I don't think I can continue any. So, what can we say that's positive right now? How can we take this out of this hole?
Why don't you touch on what BJ Cramp's got going on over there at Rock and or Roll, just so we can credit him a little bit.
Yes.
And let him know that we're only doing this one, man.
That's true. We're not taking his. Yeah. I don't even think he's going to do this one. So it was interesting that on the day of that we are recording, that I saw that he just released. He's doing a whole series covering the Motley Crue catalog that we are on a later episode. But his first one, you know, Too Fresh for Love, just dropped. It's a very entertaining listen. Some cool interviews that he put on there too from back in the day, and yeah, it should be definitely that is the album. That's my point is. When you hear this, you need to listen to Too Fast for Love or Shout the Devil to cleanse. Yeah,
some kind of the palate evils. Cleanser. Yeah. So.
Yeah. So.
So but, yeah, but check out Billy's or BJ's program. He's going to do like a whole. I think he said he was doing every record, but I think he was going to combine them once he got towards the end. Yeah, we're on Girls, Girls, Girls if you want to check that out. But yeah, like you said, Too Fast for Love is out right now. I think they come out every other week.
Yep. So, I don't know, man.
Yeah, let's get the fuck out of here. Rock's not dead.
But rad divided by gnarly equals squish.
Let me piss and I'll call you back. Mine's not. Well, mine's just a thing.
Oh, I thought you had that. You didn't like this track, period. So
I'm not talking about the track. Did you hear what I just said?
Sorry, I did. I just wanted to say when we're okay. Just go ahead. Yeah. Take it from the top.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune in to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.